We're going to start off with our first guest. It's intriguing. There's a lot of material to talk about with this guy. His name is Jeff Grant, and he is the executive director of Family Reentry right here in Bridgeport, Connecticut. So welcome, Jeff. How are you?
Good, JJ. How are you? Thank you for having me on the show.
Jeff, I am thrilled you could be here. You have an amazing story, and you're doing amazing things. So let's start, if that's okay with you, for you to tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved with Family Reentry.
Well, first let me say that Family Reentry is a nonprofit serving the criminal justice community in three cities, primarily Bridgeport, New Haven, and Norwalk, and we have satellite programs in five different cities. And I'm now the executive director of Family Reentry, but I was on its board of directors for almost 8 years, and Family Reentry was fundamental in my own reentry from prison. So I guess that's the first hint to your listeners that the story isn't going to be typical, because I am the first person incarcerated for white-collar crime in this country to be appointed as executive director of a criminal justice nonprofit.
Wow. So Family Reentry was there for you when you got out of prison.
That's true. I wasn't a recipient of programs from Family Reentry. I wasn't a client of Family Reentry, but they reached out their hand to me, and at a time that was very difficult in my life and in my family's life, they accepted me as a volunteer, and then very soon thereafter asked me to be on its board of directors. And for most of that 8 years, I was the only formerly incarcerated person on their board of directors, and I was able to bring that unique perspective to them, which I think was helpful in them making their decisions to grow and further understand and have compassion and empathy for the clients we serve.
Absolutely.
And in fact, right now I'm up in Hartford, as you know.
You're jumping ahead.
Okay, sorry,
I want to get to that, because this is really important what you are doing today.
Mm-hmm.
You are in Hartford, and all right, we might as well spill the beans a little bit about that, because first of all, I know that the Governor Malloy, has cut funding. I believe it's about $1 million from the Corrections Community Support Services. Is that correct?
He's cut it from the Department of Corrections.
Okay.
The CSSD, the Community Support Services, also has a budget, and we contract with both of them. Both of their budgets have been cut. We'd like to think that, or at least we'd like to hope that either those budgets will be restored, or if they're not restored, that we will not have any cuts to our contracts. Since last year, frankly, was a devastating year where we received $2 million worth of contract cuts from the Department of Corrections, and it decimated ours and all of our other fellow nonprofit providers. It decimated our community behavioral health services. So there are no non-residential community behavioral health services left in the state of Connecticut that are funded by Department of Corrections and mandated through parole.
Oh,
that means there's an awful lot of people being released from prison who are not going to have access to the kind of services they need to ensure their success in the community. And unfortunately, there will be a lot of them who will probably recidivate and go back to the behavior that got them into trouble in the first place and probably back to prison.
Well, if parole demands that they have it, is that part of their parole, that they go to these particular services?
Well, the way it worked historically in Connecticut is that the Department of Corrections would contract with a provider, different providers in different regions. We were a provider of behavioral health services in Bridgeport.
Mm-hmm.
And then pursuant to that contract, anybody who was released from prison would then be assigned a parole officer, and if that person needed behavioral health services, emotional services, mental health services, substance abuse services, soft skill services, then that parole officer was required to, by mandate, was required to refer them to us or to other similar providers.
Right.
That system no longer is in place.
That's really bad, because I would imagine that coming out of an institution, that there would be a lot of need for those particular services. And readjusting and just coming out alone and having been there and then having come out, it's a world of difference.
Well, I was in prison for 14 months, and I can tell you that my reintegration into the community, what the success of it was highly dependent upon the resources that were made available to me. And in fact, drug and alcohol counseling was required by my sentencing judge. And it was a lifesaver for me. I don't know what I would have done if I had gone from being incarcerated immediately out to the street with no kind of services. And yet, that's the standard right now in Connecticut, other than residential, which is still remain intact. But we believe that the Department of Corrections has a ideology the same as we do. That we believe that if the money was there, they would have kept these programs in place. And unfortunately, the budget requires some drastic cuts, and this is what got cut.
Wow. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Hopefully that'll change in the future.
Well, we'll continue to talk about that. In fact, what I need to ask you right now, Jeff, is if you'd hold on a little bit. We're going to take a break and come back to you, because I have lots more questions, and I do want to hear more about what will be going on tonight up in Hartford, okay?
Thanks, JJ.
All right. And for Jim Buchanan, I'm JJ Kennedy. We're speaking with the Executive Director of Family Reentry, Jeff Grant. And Jeff, now you are up in Hartford, and today you'll be giving testimony before the Connecticut State Legislature for the Appropriations Committee for some funding for your organization. And I think one of the things that I read about your organization, or some of the facts that you had given to me previously, so I would understand all of this, is that this kind of stunned me. Over 12,000 returning citizens are released from prison each year in Connecticut. Is that correct?
I think that's still a pretty good number, yeah.
Yeah, and so when these folks get out, it would be imperative for them to have some sort of services to help them, as your the name of your organization is, re-enter into society.
Yeah, I think that there's an entire philosophy that we're trying to advance in the state of Connecticut, and frankly nationwide, within our advocacy efforts. And first, I would say that the most important thing to us and is to strengthen communities and make them places where people don't wind up going to prison in the first place.
I was going to ask you about, but I didn't think your organization really did anything with crime prevention, but because it seems like you're more like after the fact than before the fact. Or do you do something with crime prevention?
No, we do intervention, prevention. We do youth and family services. We do domestic violence. We're actually the largest domestic violence organization in the state. We have other programs for fatherhood programs. We have in-prison programs. So we run the gamut from early intervention, basically from cradle to career. And we'd like to think eventually from cradle to pardon, to have a systemic flow and understanding of what it is that interferes with the success of a family, of an ecosystem, of a community, and try to do early intervention so that hopefully we can strengthen the family, strengthen the community, whether it be through better health care, education, stronger family bonds, better mental health, better family counseling, and disrupt the intergenerational cycle of incarceration, hopefully where it starts, and not have to wait till after someone goes to prison and then have to be in a position where we have to provide these services. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could actually have a society that was dedicated to treating everyone equal? All people are people, and we're not going to let anybody fall through the cracks from the very beginning.
When you speak about the early intervention, what I'm curious about is, so do you go out, does your organization go out to different places to talk about things that would be helpful in preventing folks ending up in the system? Or is it that you are doing early intervention with, say, the children of families who are already in the system to stop them at that point? Or both?
No, we do both. We have a very robust advocacy and outreach program. We do a lot of speaking. We do speaking in schools and colleges. We do speaking in houses of worship. We speak in prisons. We have a lot of testimonial and evidence-based information that we give out. We're one of the few organizations that actually employs formerly incarcerated people, and that is a unique model that we think allows people, and especially youth and at-risk youth, to relate to the people who are speaking to them. Frankly, I'm one of them. I speak in churches and synagogues and at colleges all the time, and sometimes it's a cautionary tale.
That I'm
telling, which I know you're interested in hearing my story, so I'm sure we're going to get there. But but there's no doubt that some of it is, for the grace of God go I, and we'd like to avoid people having to go down this path and choosing this disruptive behavior or unethical behavior. And anything we can do to help is certainly in our mandate.
So if people or organizations want you to come and speak, they just contact Family Reentry and they would get a speaker to come to their organization, their church, their temple, their function, that someone would come and speak about this particular issue, which is good, right?
It's happening on a weekly basis.
Good.
Almost every day, and we tailor the message to that particular audience. Obviously, if we're speaking at a at a middle school, it's different than if we're speaking at a law school.
I would hope so. All right. Well, I want to ask you, I know you did white collar crime, and I also want to get to the part about where how you can help people who have been in for non-white collar crimes. For Jim Buchanan, I'm J.J. Kennedy, and we're speaking with Executive Director of Family Reentry of Bridgeport, Connecticut, Jeff Grant. And Jeff, first of all, you've never written a book about your life, have you?
My book is probably 7/8 finished, and I'm out at literary agents.
Oh, really? I just took a stab at that.
We'll see how it goes.
All right. Well, why don't you tell us a little bit then, without you know, a spoiler alert, without giving us anything too important to the book. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll go on to another question.
Well, I'm happy to tell it all. That's part of my story, and that's part of what I speak about and write about.
Well, save some for the book and the movie, the movie version.
So in 1992, I suffered a sports injury, and in the course of recovery from that, I became addicted to prescription painkillers. And for approximately the next 10 years, I was addicted. I put the painkillers before my work, before my love of my family. They interfered with my judgment. They prevented me from doing the things that I needed to do. And despite that, we had a successful law practice in Westchester County. And in about 1999 or so, we were running out of cash. And it became clear that I wasn't going to be able to make payroll. So instead of going to the bank or going to a friend who could have lent me the money short term, I made the decision to invade my client escrow fund and borrow the money from that fund, which of course is illegal. And it was a crazy thing to do. I'm not sure why I did it, but
the drugs, I would think that that is such a big issue today. Dependencies on these drugs is a huge issue, which we'll have to talk about another time on WICC. But I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I do see where that totally could change your mindset and your way of thinking.
Yeah, it certainly makes me empathetic with all these kids who are dying because of opioid abuse and things like that. And I went through it. And after I had borrowed that money from the escrow account, my life was never the same. I was looking over my shoulder, I was afraid. I was really no longer available to my family. I was I was afraid.
Yeah.
And 9/11 came along, and I took that very, very hard. Again, maybe because of the drugs, I don't know. But I stopped being able to work almost entirely, and there were advertisements on TV and the radio for businesses that were affected by 9/11, and there was a loan program to help them. And at that point, my business had been cut basically in half. So I called them up and I asked them if I would qualify for a 9/11 loan. And they told me, because I lived in Westchester County and there were seven counties that were entitled to get these loans, and Westchester was one of them because of its proximity to Manhattan, I applied for the loan. And for reasons, again, I do not understand, despite the fact that I would have been approved for the loan, I embellished the loan application, and on the application put down that I had an office in Manhattan that I didn't have.
Okay.
So that was a fraud that I had committed. Soon thereafter, it became clear that I wasn't going to be able to save my law firm, and kind of reeling from the drugs and all, I resigned my law license. And the same day as I resigned my law license, I took an overdose of the painkillers and tried to kill myself. And that was in 2002, and that's pretty much the end of the first part of my life.
Yeah.
From there, I went to rehab at mm-hmm. Silver Hill Hospital in New Canaan, and I spent 7 weeks there. And I came out, and I entered a recovery community in Rye, where I lived, and then in Greenwich, where I started going to meetings and moved my family to soon thereafter. And I found my way back slowly in recovery and became a person who could be reliable again, and gained some self-respect back. And when I was about 20 months sober, I got a call from the FBI.
Oh, that must have been sobering.
It's not something you want to happen in your life if you can avoid it.
Because I was wondering when the prison came in from but okay.
So this was a full 3 years after I had submitted that loan application, and almost 2 years after I became sober. I'm currently sober 14 and a half years, so I pretty much know the timeline. And they told me there was a warrant out for my arrest.
Wow.
In connection with that loan. And I went downtown to the federal courthouse and surrendered, and I was arrested. And from there, it took about 2 more years for me to get sentenced.
Wow.
So, it took a long time. And I was sentenced to 18 months incarceration, of which I served 13 and a half months at Allenwood Correctional Institution in White Deer, Pennsylvania, and that was a low-security prison. It wasn't camp like you see on TV or
no tennis.
About camp fed. It wasn't that. This was real prison with bars and barbed wire and dogs and all that. And I got out, and then I spent a few weeks in a halfway house in Hartford, and then home detention, and then 3 years on federal supervised release.
Wow.
And step by step, I had to make my way back.
And you did.
Well, I'm one of the fortunate ones, for sure. I mean, it's wonderful to look back on it now and say I survived it. But in truth, it was extremely difficult. It was the hardest thing I could imagine ever going through in my life.
I can imagine, but you did it. And that is what gives hope to other people. They can do it, too. For Jim Buchanan, I'm J.J. Kennedy, speaking with Jeff Grant, Executive Director of Family Reentry. Jeff, just a couple more questions. Your story is going to make a really good book and great movie. Who's going to play you in the movie, do you know? Who would you like to have play you in the movie?
Whoever plays Bosch on that Netflix show, he's fantastic.
Oh, I don't
that's
know.
The guy.
What is his name? Chris? Chris knows.
I don't know his name.
His name is Titus Welliver.
That's it, Titus Welliver.
Wow,
that's
okay.
Like to play me.
All right, so now we have that name to look for. All right, here's my second to last question, because we are running a little short on time now. Mm-hmm. But you did do white collar crime. What happens when people come to you who have not done that type of crime, but rather some other?
Well, Family Reentry, that I'm now the executive director of, it's a project that's primarily for people in the inner cities in Connecticut. Not exclusively, but we don't make any distinction between a white-collar crime or a violent crime or a drug crime. We treat everybody, and we treat their families equally. I do have another project that I'm the executive director of. That's kind of my night job. It's called the Progressive Prison Ministries, and it's based in Greenwich, and it's the first prison ministry in the country created to support white-collar criminals and their families. So I'm pretty busy. Between those two projects, I mean, this is my mission. But we do capture a lot of people who have problems, and they don't really know, they don't have any way through the problem to get out the other side without help. I mean, for example, in the White Collar Project, we have clients all over the country, because white collar crime is not really geographically specific.
Right.
So we hold an online support group every Tuesday night on GoToMeeting online. So mm-hmm. we've had as many as 33 people have participated, and it's kind of like running a recovery meeting, but for people who have committed white collar crimes, been to prison, and come back.
I think with any kind of crime, if anyone needs help, I think one of the first things they need to do is just talk about it, or have someone that they are able to talk with regarding this, without shame, without any kind of judgment. And I think that these groups within your family reentry are wonderful, and your personal mission.
Yeah, I think that the key is to no longer live in isolation, and to live in community and have some accountability. And whether that's accountability in a faith environment, or accountability in a job environment, or accountability, most of the people who come to family reentry were never really afforded the kind of opportunities that, say, many of us have had in our lives. And They're struggling. They're trying to survive on the streets, or they're trying to survive with poor education. You know, for example, some of our inner cities in Connecticut have very low-rated education systems, and relatively few people who graduate from there. And I can't even imagine what it's like to try to navigate life without a high school diploma and try to get a job.
Well, you're in Hartford right now, and tonight you'll be giving testimony to the Connecticut State Legislature for appropriations. But I also know you do have fundraising efforts, and one is called the Rock and Roll Event of the Millennium. Not too small a name, okay? This is the Rock and Roll Event of the Millennium, and it is going to be at the Warehouse in Fairfield, Connecticut, April 13th at 6:30 p.m. And anything you would like to tell us about that, fundraising type events?
No, I'm glad you gave me an opportunity to talk about that, because this is kind of unique. And most fundraisers in Fairfield County are kind of dowdy, or they're held in ballrooms of hotels. But here we're having an out-and-out rock and roll concert party, and the rock group that's going to be headlining is called Blue Coop, and it's members of Blue Oyster Cult and the Alice Cooper Band.
Wow.
So these are two very famous bands. While Alice Cooper Band is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And opening for them is going to be the School of Rock in Fairfield.
Oh, that's great. Good.
Yeah, so we're very excited about that. And you know, tickets are online. If you go to familyreentry.org, that's our website, and you can click through to get tickets. We're positive it's going to be sold out. It's going to be a real barn burner, and we're happy to have that kind of energy delivered to the community, and try to capture people who are younger and also are interested in criminal justice, but also interested in having a really great time for a kind of event that they don't usually get to go to. So this is going to be a blast. It's at the Warehouse in Fairfield Theater Company Warehouse on April 13th. Doors open at 6:30 p.m. and please come.
Yeah.
I also want to make sure I give you my contact information.
Okay, do that.
It's at familyreentry.org, And it's jeffgrant@familyreentry.org is my email. And I'd like to hear from anybody who's interested in criminal justice, who wants to donate some time, become a mentor. Certainly, financial donations are appreciated. We're a nonprofit 501c3, and all donations are tax deductible to the extent permitted by law. But without the support of the community and private donations, we wouldn't be able to do the amazing work that we do and the creative work we do in trying to help people through the prison system and out and to become taxpayers on the other side.
Jeff, I'll go over that again at the end of the show so people have that information. I can't thank you enough, and I do wish you good luck tonight with your testimony at the Criminal Justice System, Connecticut State Legislature Appropriations. Hope you get the money that's needed for this particular wonderful organization. Thank you so much for your time today, Jeff, and good luck tonight.
Thank you, JJ. Wonderful being on.
All right. We'll speak again. I want to hear how it goes. All right. Thank you, sure. Jeff Grant.